I understand. Further discussion on the bill? If not, I'll close the work session on 2511.
Mr. Chair, before Barbara leaves, maybe we should ask her to kind of give us an idea if there's a Senate bill handy that we could work on in the next couple days to review.
I'm not aware of a representative bill. I'm not aware of one that has an obvious relationship, but I'd have to research a little bit exactly what it is that has been introduced and gone through process for the Senate. If there's something, I definitely will bring that information back to you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's your buddy.
I'll close the work session on 2511 and open it on Senate Bill, reluctantly, on Senate Bill 301.
Reluctantly?
Reluctantly.
This was Randy's bill.
Counsel, can you remind us of, well, no, you didn't remind us. We have some representatives from the Oregon State Bar here to answer the questions that we had Tuesday night.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
Could I ask Diana Godwin a question? Is it a requirement of every one of your committees of the Oregon State Bar to produce one piece of legislation in order to have a committee?
You want them to cut back? Is that it?
Keep busy.
I would like to volunteer to represent Bellamy that I was on a bar committee that did not produce any legislation.
Oh, bless you.
Is that why you're no longer on it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, briefly for the record, I'm Diana Godwin representing the Oregon State Bar. At the other evening's hearing, members of the committee had several questions, and I'm here tonight to answer them. Perhaps the first and easiest question was, how many other states beside Oregon are currently considering this amendment? And I have provided for you on the right-hand side of your packet the second sheet in behind the sheet that says information packet. There is a sheet titled A Few Facts About the Uniform Determination of Death Act. There it lists for you the states that have adopted it, and I was out of date in my information the other night. I thought it was 23 plus the District of Columbia. It's 29 plus the District of Columbia, so 30 in total have enacted it, and I have updated the states that are currently considering it. Besides Oregon, there are four others: Massachusetts, New Jersey, North Dakota, and West Virginia. That takes care of the easier one there, and it's all answered for you. The other question that was raised, particularly with regard to the vote in the Senate, the vote in the Senate, as I said, was 16 yes votes. There were 9 no votes and 5 legislators who are attending legislative business. The major issues that were raised during that debate, I've had a verbatim transcript prepared of the entire debate on the Senate floor, and I won't go through that in detail, but highlight to you the major questions. Senator Hannon from Ashland asked why a determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. We discussed that question the other evening. Took that line 8 saying that a determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards, and Representative Bauman was more astute than I in pointing out then that the accepted medical standards are going to apply to the question of whether or not there's been irreversible cessation of either of those circulatory or brain functions. But Senator Hannon was concerned that he said, my concern centers around the vagueness of what is open to determination. There are, as I'm aware, existing case law that says when the brain waves cease, that is a definition that is used sometimes. My concern here is that perhaps we are expanding that to allow a person to make a determination that I'm not really certain of what the impact is. My concern is that it is a little too open-ended, and for that reason, I am voting no. Reading this discussion, it seems to be that he's too concerned that people are going to be able to declare people dead too quickly. Senator Tro then asked the question, As I read the analysis, it says the primary difference in the Uniform Determination Death Act is that it requires irreversible cessation of all brain functions, including the brain stem, whereas existing law requires irreversible cessation of spontaneous brain function, but does not refer to the brain stem. My question is, was there testimony in the committee about whether or not by changing the definition and adding the brain stem into the functioning of the brain that must cease before you can declare death, was there likely to be the situation where, for all intents and purposes, somebody is dead, but the brain stem continues to function? And for that reason, he was going to vote no. Senator Brenneman responded that testimony in committee was that when these situations occur, that is, that there is a cessation of cortical activity but still activity in the brain stem, that situation is very short term. Senator Trow asked, is that a long period of time? What are we talking, weeks or days? Senator Brenneman said weeks or days is short term. And he voted no because if there's no chance of recovering and the brain stem continues to function, this simply adds a great burden to families. So you can see that some of the no votes were for one reason and some of the no votes were for the other. And I have brought with me tonight an attorney who has been actively involved in this from the Spears Liberski firm, Ted Falk. Particularly, if you had questions about that brain stem activity question, Mr. Falk is here. He's also, I understand, prepared written remarks. Have they been distributed?
Yes, they have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh. Representative Bellamy.
I was contacted today by a long day.
Yesterday.
The representative of the Catholic Church.
Bob Castagna.
Bob indicates that they very much support Senate Bill 301A engrossed. And I will tell you that that relieves a lot of my concern simply for the fact that they are very active in this particular issue and spend a lot of time really researching it. And I would say that if it was expanding the ability to more quickly determine that somebody was, in essence, legally dead, they would not be supporting it. So I'm very comfortable with the language. I don't really need to hear a lot of technicalities about it myself.
Are there questions of Mr. Falk?
Okay. All the way down here, and I don't get to see
who I should add here with my witness on the uniform.
my name for the record is Ted Falk.
Sometimes you win, Diane, and sometimes you lose.
Well, I think maybe I do have a question. I just want to think out loud on this. I am uncertain that, well, what do the words accepted medical standards mean?
I think one of the concerns...
They refer to something that already exists out there, wherever it is, and they're dynamic, if I understand it correctly.
That's the key point, that the criteria are dynamic. When there was first formulated the idea of using brain death as the criterion for the determination of death, the prevailing criteria were known as the Harvard criteria. And since that time, there have been two or three changes in the criteria which were used. I think the notion of accepted medical standards is supposed to incorporate the idea that the particular medical standards might change from time to time, even though they are still fitting in within the general statutory notion of an irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain. Indeed, I believe that the standards, although they're relatively simple tests, the test which is generally done today is somewhat different from the test that was done in 1976 when the Oregon statute first was enacted.
Is there in the statute now a definition of what it means to be dead? 146.001?
146.001 is the closest thing we've got to a definition of death. Unfortunately, the language of the statute doesn't really provide a definition of anything. So I can't say plainly that that does constitute a definition of death. What it really does is indicate what procedure a physician has to go through in making a particular determination. So it, from a drafting standpoint, it is slightly defective. But apart from that technicality, the 146.001, which Engross Senate Bill 301 would repeal, is the current definition of death.
Is there further discussion? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I would move Senate Bill 301 to full committee with DUPAS recommendation, even though the representative from the Oregon State Bar brought the witness down here for very little reason.
We appreciate the fact that you did come down here. I think there is some concern about this, and it's probably a... it's in an area that one is sometimes in our position, it's pretty important when you're dealing with the area. I'll place the motion. Representative Bellamy is to do pass to the full committee. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, Gloria, will you call the roll?
Representative Bellamy?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dix?
No.
Aye.
No. Motion is adopted. Do I have a volunteer?
I'll carry it.
Representative Bauman.
I was going to say, I always carry marriage proposals. I have to carry the ones on death, too. But I'll
cheer a little bit.
I'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 497. Council.
Senate Bill 497 would allow service of summons through the Adult and Family Services Division to enforce visitation rights. And I'd like to point out, before we go much further, that there are some amendments before you, 497A-2, which correct a typographical glitch in the A engrossed bill. The amendments, unfortunately, have a glitch in them themselves. They should read, in line 19 of the printed A engrossed bill, delete the second obligee and insert obligor.
Almost like law school.
It is almost like law school, isn't it?
I don't know.
We have this set for public hearing, Ira.
Keep going. Sure, my package is 31 bucks.
For the record, my name is Ira Zero, representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and the Oregon Human Rights Coalition. And we oppose this bill. The bill is, as it's written, violates two federal statutes. And it essentially is one which, if passed, would be inviting, in my opinion, a losing lawsuit. I don't think that these the two areas can be cured. First thing that it does is it requires essentially the release of the address of a recipient of AFDC. That's violative of federal statutes. The second thing that it does is it makes people who are recipients of AFDC submit to service of, to accept service through AFS, basically, in order to retain their eligibility for AFDC. That is an additional eligibility requirement. Federal law makes it illegal to add additional federal eligibility requirements to federal programs. For those two reasons, neither of which I can see can be cured, we oppose the bill and feel that it would be unwise to proceed.
So. There are questions of this witness. Are there other witnesses on this bill? Come forward, please. You can stay right there, Aaron.
Mr. Chairman, Lawrence Young of the Attorney General's Office, Family Law Section. The Department of Justice neither supports nor opposes this particular bill as it relates to the central concept, which is to provide service of process on children. However, we were concerned about the bill, and we wanted to advise you that the success of the bill may well hinge on whether Congress does change federal law in this area. The primary reason for that is, as Ira recently stated, was that the bill might be interpreted to impose or to propose an additional condition for eligibility for public assistance programs. Eligibility conditions are set by federal statute and regulation. This bill would require an applicant or recipient of ADC to submit to service of process for purposes of enforcing visitation rights, and that might be held by a court to amount to imposition of an additional condition for ADC eligibility. I don't think you can cure that problem. It can be cured by Congress in Amendment 2 U.S. Code to allow the Adult and Family Services Division or any 4A agency, public welfare agency, to provide such service. Second reason that the bill may run afoul of federal law is that it requires AFS to divulge the address of the custodial parent as the bill is currently written. In subsection 1C of the bill, this is the Ayen-Gross bill, the division is required to give the obligor the return receipt. Such receipts typically contain the custodial parent's address, and that would be, those addresses are confidential. That would directly violate 42 U.S. Code section 602A9. That could be cured by this committee, by an amendment which would provide that you don't have to give the obligee's address on your return receipt, and so you could probably get around that particular problem. The third, more subtle problem also has to do with the confidentiality regulation, and that is that, in essence, the bill requires the Adult and Family Services Division to use confidential information, i.e. the obligee's address, to accomplish a purpose that isn't connected with administration of the public assistance program. In other words, the service of process on a custodial parent. That proposed bill might be held to violate 42 U.S. Code section 602A9 on that particular point. This problem cannot be cured, in my opinion, by this committee. It would have to be cured by a change in federal law.
Questions of either of these witnesses?
Chair?
Representative Bellamy.
Who supports the bill?
That is a good question. I had some requests that this be put up for a public hearing, and I was trying to rack my memory on it, and I cannot for the life of me. It's not the chair's intent to open a work session on Senate Bill 497.
Sure, you'll take a motion to table?
I prefer not to.
Mr. Chairman, it might have been Senator Cohen because she was a member of the Governor's Commission on Child Support Enforcement.
And I understand the intent behind the bill may have been laudable. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 497 and ask if there's any further business to come before the committee, subcommittee this evening. Hearing none, we're adjourned.